The amount of plastic produced on Earth, the UN says the equivalent of 2,000 garbage trucks full of plastic are dumped into rivers, lakes, and oceans each day. Groups have a goal of reaching an agreement on a treaty to address plastic pollution. Right now, more than 400 million tons of new plastic produced each year. I'm Brian Clark, ABC News.
Matt Nair on air.
Jimmy Cuska said that Wisconsin's official state speed trap is in Rosendale.
Do you get like a souvenir sticker?
A t-shirt? I got pulled over in Rosendale and all I got was this lousy ticket.
It can't be official.
If there's no merch, it's not a thing. Troy from Mount Horeb.
There is merch. The original convenience store in Rosendale has a shirt that says Rosendale. That's the ticket.
Now I think we're going to have to do a road trip to Rosendale just to get merch.
Matt Nair on air. Weekdays at 11 on 92.7 WMDX and the Civic Media app. The Todd Alba Show.
Trevi Olson, senior advisor at the Lincoln Project.
We as individuals need to be far better in terms of getting the tools we need to have the conversations. You're never going to shame someone out of their political beliefs.
Yes.
You're never going to get them with talking points.
You nailed it. And I think that that's what some of our friends on the left don't get. And I think it's destructive and it's not beneficial.
The Todd Alba Show. Weekdays, noon till 2 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app.
Ever tried balancing a dozen eggs in one hand while hopping on one foot? Or maybe juggling cats while riding the unicycle? Sounds ridiculous, right? But guess what? That's exactly what texting while driving is like. Your human brain only has the capacity to focus on one thing at a time. So when you're behind the wheel, give driving your undivided attention.
Don't drive distracted. A message brought to you by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, Project Yellow Light, and the Ad Council.
Your news, conversations, and a whole lot of fun. It's all on your local Civic Media radio station or the Civic Media app. The Dom Salvia Show.
Harvey Kay, Professor Emeritus of Democracy at the University of Wisconsin, Green Bay. Harvey, I know you're the big FDR expert.
In 1934, he decided that the inequality and the wealth accumulated at the top was a threat not only to the American economy, but also to the American democratic spirit, American democratic life.
Sounds like history's repeating itself.
The Dom Salvia Show. Weekdays from 4 till 6 on the Civic Media Radio Network and on the Civic Media app.
The possibility of lung cancer can be pretty scary, especially if you're one of approximately 8 million current or former smokers at high risk. That's why SaveByTheScan.org wants you to know that now there's a breakthrough low-dose CT scan that can detect lung cancer early, and it only takes 60 seconds. You stop smoking, now start screening. For an easy quiz to see if you're eligible, visit SaveByTheScan.org. It could save your life. SaveByTheScan.org is brought to you by the American Lung Association's Lung Force Initiative and the Ad Council.
This is your hometown radio, refreshed, keeping you informed, entertained, and connected locally across the Civic Media Network.
For Civic Media News, I'm Savannah Tomei Olson. Wisconsin lags behind our neighbors when it comes to wind energy. We rank 26th in the nation. We only have 10 wind projects here, but advocates say adding more would benefit everyone. Here's Judith Ruiz Branch.
Wisconsin has about 900 megawatts of installed wind capacity compared to neighbors that produce more than 10,000 megawatts. Experts say better wind resources in neighboring states and lower solar costs enticing the state to invest in other projects contribute to the lag. Wisconsin farms are also smaller than those in the Great Plains states, says Sam Denisky with Renew Wisconsin.
You can't just put two turbines right next to each other, right? The atmospheric dynamics requires a little bit more spacing in between turbines.
But Denisky says the state's wind potential is high. Some Wisconsin utilities have already added wind options to their portfolios, and all have set goals to reduce carbon emissions. At least a handful of wind energy projects are planned for Wisconsin in the coming year. Another challenge is misinformation, that wind turbines are noisy, negatively affect property values, or pose health risks. Denisky says most of those claims are not supported by scientific evidence. What has been proven, he says, is that wind energy is less harmful to wildlife and the environment than traditional power generation.
We have the potential here to do our own energy in our own state, to add great paying jobs like wind turbine technicians to the mix. And we also give landowners kind of like a lifeline in this aspect.
He adds farmers who have been hit hard economically in recent years could benefit from gaining an additional income stream by leasing land for these projects. For Wisconsin News Connection, I'm Judith Ruiz Branch. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
You're listening to Civic Media News. I'm Savannah Tomei Olson.
You can always continue the conversation on social media. Share your thoughts when you find and follow Civic Media on Facebook, X, and Instagram.
With your forecast, I'm Corey Hartman. For today, sunshine and highs in the low 20s, wind chills around zero. For tonight, mostly clear with a low of 9. Sunshine, 25 for Sunday, mostly sunny Monday with a high near 29. 29 and partly sunny on Tuesday, 37 Wednesday.
Right now, it's 15.
Todd Albaugh.
Hey, everybody, join us next time, an all-new live show back in the studio. Join us for a look back at the holiday weekend and prepare you for the week ahead.
The Todd Albaugh Show, weekdays noon till 2.
A new choice.
Madison's Real News and Great Conversation, 92.7 WMDX. Welcome to Amicus, a law review with Jim Santel. Civic Media's weekly review and discussion of some of the most significant news stories in the areas of law, government, courts, and the aspiration for justice. And now, here's your host, Jim Santel.
This is Amicus, a law review, and my name is Jim Santel. This is our weekend weekly review, our analysis, our assessment, and our description, our discussion with you of those major areas of law and justice and the rule of law in America and beyond. Thank you so very much for joining me and my producer, Max, once again here on Civic Media as we undertake, as always, an ambitious but achievable syllabus on our weekend broadcast, talking about all of those important things that animate our lives and our livelihoods here in Wisconsin, throughout the United States of America, and also across the globe, no exception this weekend broadcast at all. And so let me talk first a little bit about our agenda, our syllabus for this weekend. We are going to begin with what is undeniably one of the major rule of law stories of the year, happening just this past week. And you know what that is. That is the dismissal, the decision by the Department of Justice, the special counsel, by our Attorney General, Merrick Garland, to abandon those two pieces of major criminal prosecution against a man named Donald John Trump. He is going to become the next president of the United States of America in just about 52 days from now. The decision by the Department of Justice to abandon, to dismiss those criminal prosecutions underway for a very long time. Prosecutions begun by returns by grand juries, both in Washington, D.C. and in South Florida, finding that the former and future president of the United States of America did, in fact, engage in crimes in violations of the federal criminal code in America, including that case in Washington, D.C., alleging election interference, an attempt to overthrow, to undermine the election of 2020. Four counts there, now dismissed, now taken off the docket of District Court Judge Tanya Chutkan. And in South Florida and in the 11th Circuit, the decision equally important, equally significant, I'm going to argue, as I have in the past, equally catastrophic for the rule of law, to take off the calendar of the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals that until last week, just this past week, the last few business days, had on its docket a determination of whether or not the decision by Eileen Cannon to dismiss the case based upon her conclusion, unsupported by precedent, unsupported by the law, that Jack Smith, the prosecution, the prosecutor in those cases, had no authority to do so, improperly appointed by the Attorney General. That matter pending until just days ago before the 11th Circuit, now removed also from the 11th Circuit calendar almost completely, but with an exception, and that is two lingering defendants also charged along with Donald Trump with, yes, that's right, obstruction of justice. We'll get back to that and explain how all of that works. One of the most significant rule of law decisions, one of the most significant rule of law administration of justice events in 2024, arguably in recent years. The determination by the Department of Justice that those cases cannot go ahead, premised upon a policy not applicable right now, that a sitting president cannot be subject to prosecution. We'll get back to all of that, explain what's going on there, why those decisions by our Department of Justice so important, so disappointing in terms of what could and should have happened to ensure that we have information, we have insight, we have legal perspective on unresolved questions that, yes, indeed, would never see the light of day in the context of a trial in either the Washington insurrection case or the South Florida case. But nonetheless, important for the future of America, very significant for the rule of law. All of that abandoned by the Department of Justice just this past week. We'll review again what the status of that New York case is. Still pending in front of Juan Merchan without a sentencing date of the defendant. His name, once again, Donald Trump. No resolution yet on an underlying immunity decision there. No resolution yet on any sentencing. And exactly what's going to go on there, we'll talk about that again, as we did last week, and update you in that matter, and then also simply reaffirm the status of that other state case pending in Georgia. That case pending before the Georgia Court of Appeals, talking about, in the end, the way that virtually all of these criminal cases brought by grand juries upon findings of probable cause that Donald Trump engaged in crimes against the state of New York, state of Georgia, against the federal government, all of them almost certainly finishing now with a whimper and not any final judgment, which is commonplace, which is traditional, which is usual, which is expected for every other criminal case in America, state cases, federal cases alike. We'll talk more about that at the top of our discussion here on Amicus Law Review. Then also going to return to a common subject matter here on our weekend broadcast, and that is, what is the Supreme Court doing? What are those nine justices of our high court, what are they up to these days? We know that they have just recently begun their 2024-2025 term that lasts, yes, indeed, until late September of next year, anticipating once again in May, probably June, maybe into July as well, the return of major cases. We'll talk about some of those. We'll talk about a major decision made by the Supreme Court just this past week to take on another case that reaffirms its continuing focus on, its continuing emphasis on agencies in America. In the political spectrum, we have seen that in the area of attacks on the so-called deep, dark administrative state. It doesn't exist. We've got wonderful, outstanding tens of thousands of civil servants out there doing their job based upon their expertise, their insight, their perspective, their experience. Nonetheless, in the political arena, an awful lot of garbage language and inappropriate discussion about how our agencies are somehow undermining America by engaging in conduct about which we know nothing. Nothing could be further from the truth. And yet, in the Supreme Court, we have seen in the last term an attack upon agencies. Remember that Loper-Bright Enterprises case that basically for the first time in 40 years removed from the quiver, if you will, of federal district court and appellate court judges the capacity to defer to agencies based upon their expertise, that thing called Chevron deference, that now wiped off the calendars, wiped off the dockets, wiped off the bench books, if you will, of judges around the country, no longer required to defer to the wisdom and the insight of those agencies. Well, the Supreme Court's at it again this term. They have taken a number of cases in the area of environment, in the area of economics, other things out there. And just this past week, adding to that yet another case, a fresh challenge to agency power, this one having to do with the Federal Communications Commission and its authority to implement a policy that would have brought broadband and other telephone services to rural communities, to impoverished communities in our nation, across the board, bringing those services to neighborhoods that have not yet had them, not been exposed to the communication possibilities of the 21st century. a decision by a lower court. Yes, that's right. It's the Fifth Circuit once again finding that the Federal Communications Commission overstepped. Now that case before the Supreme Court, and significantly another doctrine almost certainly going to be attacked and probably overturned by the Supreme Court, and that is a doctrine involving discretion. That is the discretion of agencies to act as they should according to congressional delegation. And yes, this doctrine is the non-delegation doctrine. We'll talk about what that means. We'll talk about why it's important and why this decision of just this past week on the Supreme Court docket to take on this new case signals yet again the Supreme Court's not done. The Supreme Court is not yet done in addressing a problem that does not exist, and that is this notion that, again, our agencies are somehow out there without any tether, without any guidelines and standards, and they need to be reined in. All these doctrines that have worked for centuries of American history, more recently decades of American history, this particular doctrine, the non-delegation doctrine, out there for about 84, 85 years, likely to be overturned by the Supreme Court. And once again, an attack upon a diminution of the power of our agencies to work on your behalf and my behalf, our behalf, and making certain that the government goes. We'll talk all about that, in addition to reminding you about what the Supreme Court is also doing just this coming week and in the months ahead. It's Supreme Court docket. It's Supreme Court review through the oral arguments that it does routinely. We've got four of them coming up just this week. They are scheduled through January and February and now even into March of next year. Among the almost now 15 cases, 50 cases on their docket, we'll talk about the Supreme Court in some detail in this edition, this broadcast here on our weekend show. Then in our second hour, we're going to go overseas once again, as we sometimes do. We did last week to talk about a number of different lessons to be learned from various places around the country, including France, including Brazil last week, including the International Criminal Court. This week, we're going to focus on Australia and Great Britain. Some very interesting legislation passed in both of those nations, one of them having to do with social media access for people under the age of 16, an issue that also reverberates here in America in connection with another Supreme Court case right now pending, coming out of a couple of state legislatures, and coming out of Great Britain just this past week, decisions to go ahead with an assisted dying piece of legislation. We'll talk about that as well, and its implications for us here in America as we think about those issues, too, in our nation. And then finally, a couple of very domestic, very relevant issues on our docket, one of them having to do with the return of Bible studies in the public schools, at least in Texas, maybe other places as well. We'll talk about what happened just this past week in Texas, authorizing what might be interpreted, what might in fact come to be a limited rescission of what the Supreme Court said way back in 1963 when it said that, you know what, you cannot be teaching the Bible in our public classrooms. You can read the Bible privately. Students can thoughtfully, pensively ponder and review and examine those religious texts of all the religions, but they cannot be taught that in the schools. Coming back in Texas in many ways, we're also going to chat about white supremacy and some very disturbing statistics about the return, if it ever left, of white supremacy in America. Some very disturbing statistics there that also describe, regrettably, some areas of our nation across the country where instances of white supremacy by small groups, by larger groups, are once again influencing our nation. All of that coming up on our weekend broadcast here on Amicus, a Law Review.
Welcome to Madison's Real News and Great Conversation, 92.7 WMDX.
The John and Gordy Show.
Thanks, Joe, for giving us a call this morning.
I'm really not concerned about a trans woman being in the bathroom. Mike Johnson puts this through, right? But then he says the person who's in charge of enforcing this will be the sergeant at arms. You weenie. You absolute weenie. You put this through and then you dump the enforcement on somebody else. Are you kidding? Are we really spending time on this?
Weekday mornings 6 till 8 on 92.7 WMDX and the Civic Media app. The Maggie Dawn Show.
His name's Jeff Mandel, general counsel for Law Forward.
Mr. Gableman broke more ethics laws and rules than he followed. The attorney's oath here in Wisconsin is fairly long. Mr. Gableman had, in the course of the sham investigation into the 2020 election, violated every single sentence in that oath.
The Maggie Dawn Show, weekdays from 2 till 4 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the Civic Media app.
This is Madison's Real News and Great Conversation, 92.7 WMDX.
This is Amicus Law Review. My name is Jim Santel. This hour and next hour are also joined in the studios of Civic Media here on our weekend broadcast as my producer Max, and together we are also taking your questions, your inquiries at 855-752-4842. That telephone number once again is 855-752-4842. Max and I interested in soliciting and responding to your inquiries and questions about anything on our syllabus, our ambitious syllabus this weekend broadcast. Also, encouraging you to drop into our text line, into the drop box of Civic Media, any of your questions and comments as well, and we'll take those up during the course of this hour and next hour as well. This hour beginning, as promised, with a review of what I regard, I suspect you do too, one of the major decisions in rule of law jurisprudence just this past week, and that is this major decision. After years of investigation, after years of prosecution in the federal courts in the District of Columbia, the district court there, going up to the appeals court, going up to the United States Supreme Court, and then also in southern Florida, the district court there in Fort Pierce, Florida. Both of those cases, one is the insurrection case, the election interference case, charging Donald Trump with four counts of violations of federal law when it comes to an attempt to undermine, to rescind, to overthrow the election of 2020. And the prosecution, of course, in South Florida, that's the so-called Mar-a-Lago national documents, classified documents case. That's the one in which the defendants, plural, are alleged to have taken, retained, and then also obstructed justice in an attempt to try to cover up what they did. Numerous documents coming out of the White House, documents to which the president and these others did not have entitlement. And in the wake of decisions in both of those cases, another decision just this past week by the Department of Justice not to pursue either one any further. How do these cases come about? How do these major decisions that we have talked about before, why are they so important for us in America? Well, we know about the District of Columbia case. That, once again, is this major case that spawned all of this litigation about whether or not a president is immune from prosecution for crimes, C-R-I-M-E-S, criminal conduct in the White House. And the Supreme Court saying on July 1 of last year, in this wild, this offensive, this constitution-changing decision of July 1, that indeed, for the first time in 248 years, it turns out the Constitution does in fact vest in a president, if we elect that president, the complete authority with respect to the Department of Justice, absolute immunity for anything that he, one day she, does in connection with relationships there, communications there, with respect to virtually everything else, presumptions of immunities for all the other conduct of a president. Never before seen a document like that. And again, predicated upon this notion that the president is all powerful, needs to be muscular, needs to be deft and very, very, very quick in moving on policy and practice. And that's the reason why we cannot have a president, according to John Roberts and five other members of the Supreme Court, cannot have a president who is somehow burdened with the criminal prosecution that would come in the wake of crimes that he or she may commit. It is a stunning opinion back in July. Now, from my perspective, and I suspect from the perspectives of many of you, including other Americans across our nation, around the world, now also affirmed by our attorney general and arguably by the special counsel as well, as they abandoned the very case upon which that decision was premised. You may recall well that the Supreme Court has sent back to Tanya Chutkan, the district court judge, the responsibility for doing some homework, now trying to figure out what that opinion means when it comes to applying it to the four-count superseding indictment pending in front of her. You may recall as well that in the wake of that return of that case, sending it back down to her, what did she do appropriately? She indicated, I'm going ahead with this. I'm going to begin to pursue now, after the Supreme Court, the next steps in all this. She solicited from the parties. There are statements about what should and should not happen, and you recall well that Jack Smith had submitted this omnibus, well over 100-page document outlining exactly how we could try this case, even in the wake of the Supreme Court, in the wake, yes, indeed, of a superseding indictment that changed somewhat some of the charges in response to what the Supreme Court had done. He outlined that in great detail, then followed that up with a huge compendium of documents also would have been presented to the trial court. And it was in that setting that the district court judge, Tanya Chutkan, had also asked the defense, as judges always do, what is their position? What is Donald Trump's position on what should happen? And contrary to what Jack Smith was saying, the defense had said, no, you can dismiss this case. There's nothing to try here anymore. And so Tanya Chutkan, they said, again, in opposition to what the Department of Justice was saying, they said, get rid of this case, dismiss it. And it was in that setting that a significant thing happened, and that was November 5th, in which the Supreme Court and all the rest of us looked on as America elected Donald John Trump as its next president of the United States of America. Now, why is that important? Why should that be important in connection with a continuing criminal prosecution? Often, as we've said in the past, elections and prosecutions can live side by side. They're always a part of the same system of rule of law. They're different things, but they can, in fact, should, and always have lived apart from each other in terms of one not influencing, not overtaking the other until this past week. Why? Because internal, as you well know from past history, including the Mueller report of a number of years ago, this is when this first sort of came into the public domain, this longstanding, decades-old policy, probably anachronistic now, probably should be changed by an attorney general. This policy internal to the Department of Justice that says that we do not prosecute, we do not charge, we do not pursue criminally sitting presidents of the United States of America. Important emphasis on the word sitting, S-I-T-T-I-N-G, the present incumbent of that office. And that's the reason why way back at the time of the Mueller investigation, the investigator there, the special counsel, Bob Mueller, determined that he could not prosecute a sitting president. His name was Donald Trump then. It still is Donald Trump. Why? Because he was sitting. He was in the office at the time and so referred the case, the entire matter, onto Capitol Hill, where the Congress decided not to do anything with it. In the wake of all of that, we come now to the next invocation of that principle, just applied just this past week, and that is Jack Smith announcing, probably, my guess, not completely satisfied with this result, but announcing that because Donald Trump is about to become the next incumbent of the White House, because that's going to happen soon, necessarily, that same principle that prevents a prosecution of a sitting president now applies to him, basically expanding that principle, that policy, to include a private citizen. His name, again, Donald Trump. And because of that, anticipating his presidency, anticipating that he is going to encumber that office, and therefore anticipating that the policy would apply on January 20th, dismissing now some 50 or so days before he becomes the president, dismissing those criminal prosecutions in Southern Florida, actually pending before the 11th Circuit, and also before Tanya Chutkan in the district court. Both of those motions made requesting leave of court to dismiss, asking the judges for permission to get rid of them. And both of those granted just this past week. As amicus A Law Review will continue. We were going to discuss further about why that's important, why what we have lost in the wake of those decisions, and then also talk about the other cases here on Amicus, A Law Review.
A voice for Madison, real news and great conversation, 92.7 WMDX.
ABC News, I'm Brian Clark. American consumers spent $10.8 billion online yesterday, according to Adobe Analytics, which says that's more than 10% higher than a year ago. Online shopping also helpful for some traditional Black Friday shoppers, as Margaret Swanson in Seattle explained.
With online shopping, the full crowds on Black Friday has totally died down. And I was never really into, like, I used to just really avoid it, but now I feel more open to it because it doesn't feel super overwhelming.
Freezing temperatures and heavy snow could complicate the back end of the holiday weekend. Parts of western New York could see 5 feet of lake effect snow. There are lake effect snow warnings for Ohio, Pennsylvania, and New York as sub-freezing temperatures move across the northern plains. Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau said he had an excellent conversation with President-elect Trump. Trudeau traveled to Florida after Trump said he would slap 25% tariffs on imports from Mexico and Canada. This is ABC.
Enjoying this local program? Find the complete Civic Media lineup at civicmedia.us or the Civic Media app.
The Bucks host the Wizards. Hi, I'm Mike Clemens with sports. The Bucks host the Washington Wizards tonight in Milwaukee. The Wizards trying to snap a 13-game losing streak. The Bucks held practice after a 3-day break over Thanksgiving. Head coach Doc Rivers.
Yeah, it was good. Yeah, they probably ate too much. And, you know, you always, as a coach, we look at days off differently. Like, when I saw the schedule and said, oh, yeah, we get our 3 days off with the Thanksgiving in the middle. You know, I looked at it. I don't know if I looked at it as a positive or not. Giannis had 6 days off. That's a huge stretch for him in the middle of a season or beginning of a season, so that should help his body as well.
College football, the Badgers losing their final game of the season 24-7 at home at Camp Randall Stadium to Minnesota, who reclaimed the Paul Bunyan axe. Badgers head coach Luke Fickle on just how flat his team looked.
If you can't be fired up for a rivalry game, if you can't be fired up for a game that's been played since 1890, then I mean, this probably isn't the right place for you.
That's Wisconsin's Luke Fickle with sports. I'm Mike Clemens.
Listen to the John and Gordy Show weekdays right here on WMDX, sponsored by Verlo Mattress. Sleep better, dream bigger on a handcrafted, locally made mattress. Find them on Madison.
With your forecast, I'm Corey Hartman. For today, sunshine and highs in the low 20s, wind chills around zero. For tonight, mostly clear with a low of 9. Sunshine, 25 for Sunday. Mostly sunny Monday with a high near 29. 29 and partly sunny on Tuesday. 37 Wednesday.
Right now, it's 15.
Uh-oh, Brad's buzzed.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, he's starting with the woots. And now a speech.
I just want to say that friendship is about heart. Heart and brain. Who's with me?
Good thing is, he knows when he's buzzed.
And my brain is saying, when it's time to go home, somebody call me a ride.
Love that guy.
Me too.
Know your buzzed warning signs? Call for a ride when it's time to go home. Buzz driving is drunk driving. A message from NHTSA and the Ad Council.
Nightlight with Pete Schwabba.
James Rundy.
I decided to throw off all my wild and crazy short film ways and make a straight up documentary about my uncle. He was one of the small time dairy farmers across the state that were kind of the backbone and why we got our state's name, America's Dairyland.
It was called The Last Milk. Have you ever milked a cow?
Oh, yeah.
I'm curious, but I'm scared to do it because I'm worried I might like it.
All right. Nightlight with Pete Schwabba. Weeknights from 6 till 8 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the Civic Media app. Matt Nair on air.
Jimmy Cuska said that Wisconsin's official state speed trap is in Rosendale.
Do you get like a souvenir sticker?
A t-shirt? I got pulled over in Rosendale and all I got was this lousy ticket.
It can't be official.
If there's no merch, it's not a thing. Troy from Mount Horeb.
There is merch. The original convenience store in Rosendale has a shirt that says Rosendale. That's the ticket.
Now I think we're going to have to do a road trip to Rosendale just to get merch.
Matt Nair on air. Weekdays at 11 on 92.7 WMDX and the Civic Media app.
Fear you may be missing out? We're always streaming on TuneIn and the Civic Media app. Enjoy listening live or catch up by finding the podcast at civicmedia.us or wherever you enjoy listening to your podcasts. Missed your favorite show live on air? It's easy to find what you enjoy wherever you listen to podcasts, including Spotify, Apple, and Google Podcasts. And we're always streaming on TuneIn and the Civic Media app.
Todd Albaugh.
Hey, everybody. Join us next time, an all-new live show back in the studio. Join us for a look back at the holiday weekend and prepare you for the week ahead.
The Todd Albaugh Show, weekdays noon till 2.
My name is Jim Santel. I am your host here on the broadcast stations of Civic Media, both this hour and next hour as well for Amicus, a law review. This, of course, our regular weekend review of all things justice related. This broadcast, no exception to that. Commenting, offering some perspective on this major rule of law issue that happened just this past week, that is a dismissal, the bringing to an end, the abandonment of these major federal criminal prosecutions against Donald Trump. An awful lot of focus by people saying that, well, Donald Trump escaped justice. He got away with it, as some have said. And indeed, that interpretation of the law and of what happened here is not an inappropriate one. But my concern is greater than that, and it comes from two different sources. One of them is, of course, what I implicitly described in our previous segments here on our Saturday and Sunday broadcast, and that is that there are principles out there that contemplate applications of policies and doctrines that apply right now and may or may not apply in the future. And so, as I have done in the past, invoking once again Yale professor Timothy Snyder, who talked about times of transition, times of concern about the future, and said, do not obey in advance. He said this: most of the power of authoritarianism is freely given, he wrote, in times like these. He wrote this way back in 2017, so not speaking specifically about 2024 into 2025, but times generally in the 21st century. He said, in times like these, individuals think ahead about what a more repressive government will want, and then offer themselves without being asked. And finally, he says, a citizen who adapts in this way is teaching power what it can do. That, according to Timothy Snyder in his writing about all sorts of things, lessons from the 20th century about how we should behave in the 21st. And why is that significant? Because the dismissal of these cases, from my perspective, and I suspect from many of the perspectives that you share with me, is premature. The policy upon which it is premised does not apply. And the policy probably should be rescinded anyway. This Attorney General, Merrick Garland, probably, like previous attorneys general, has complete authority to rescind this policy at any time. It is implicitly an acknowledgement of what the Supreme Court told us back in July of this past year. That is that presidents are kings and they're not subject to the rule of law like the rest of us are. When you establish and then you apply a policy that says that the chief federal law enforcement officer in the nation does not have to apply by the rules and does not have to obey the basic norms and standards by which the rest of us live, including compliance with the federal criminal law, you're basically saying that we have established a supreme presidency. We've established a kingdom once again, as Sonia Sotomayor and Elena Kagan and Ketanji Brown Jackson articulated so eloquently back in July. And along the way, with respect to this particular policy that says a sitting president cannot be prosecuted, cannot be charged, cannot prosecute a case against him, you are doing it, as Timothy Snyder said, in anticipation of something happening. You are obeying in advance and teaching what power, what it can do, anticipating a future government and offering ourselves without being asked to do so. About 52 days or so until the presidency changes and Joseph R. Biden becomes a private citizen and Donald Trump once again becomes the president of the United States of America. But right now, this weekend, this Saturday, this Sunday, the reason why the policy doesn't apply is that Donald Trump is not a sitting president. And so for the next 50 days or so, possible for these prosecutions to go ahead, not to trial, They will not see the light of day under any circumstances that are even vaguely imaginable. These cases will not go to trial, but there's something else. And this is the real reason why I am so concerned about the decision by our Attorney General, by our Department of Justice just this past week, to abandon these cases prematurely, to tell power what it can do, and to do it, most importantly, before some very significant rule of law decisions could have been made. And those, of course, relate to unresolved issues, both in that district court case and also in the case in Southern Florida. Momentous, unsettled questions about constraints on criminal wrongdoing by presidents are now left unresolved for now and in the future. Scope of presidential immunity and the capacity of special counsels to do their jobs as they've done in the past several decades. And both of those, I would offer, are incredibly important things for all of us, not just to know on all sides of the political aisle, but significant for the future enforcement of the very laws under which we live and breathe. The case, once again, the dismissal of the case in the District of Columbia, the dismissal of the case in South Florida, yes, prompts a lot of people to say that Mr. Trump, Donald Trump, escaped any criminal accountability for his actions. And that is certainly true. But it also means that these two open constitutional questions of great importance go unanswered. No definitive answers as Donald Trump takes office. One of those questions, again, is the extent to which the protection from prosecution that is now offered to presidents by the Supreme Court ruling back in July, whether that does, in fact, mean something. What is the full definition of the immunity? That was the homework given by the Supreme Court to Tanya Chutkan for acts taken while in office. Were those private? Were those public? Were those official? Were those unofficial? There is a great benefit to the rule of law and, frankly, even to the law of the case to know what the result of that would have been. It would have been intellectually interesting, yes, but more importantly, significant as a constitutional matter. In as we approach the 250th anniversary of our nation, to know whether or not this particular set of crimes could in fact have been prosecuted. And that is what we will forever be denied by virtue of the fact not only that the special counsel moved for leave of court to dismiss these cases, and also by the fact that Tanya Chutkan very promptly granted those motions. That case is over. It is done. And is now taken off her docket, and we will never know that very important thing in that case. A lot of people saying, well, wait a minute, it was dismissed based upon a notion that it might be revived at some point. It was dismissed upon the understanding that is being done without prejudice. That's the term under which the judge granted the motion to dismiss the case without prejudice. What does that mean? It means that the government can, in fact, bring it again, could reconvene another grand jury, in this case, a third grand jury, to determine whether or not there's probable cause. And yes, indeed, there's a very remote, basically non-existent option for doing that. Why? Because you still have to contend with an appropriate thing called the statute of limitations. And the statute of limitations basically expires on anything related to January 6th of 2021, 5 years from the date or dates of those events. And that brings us to 2026. That will be somewhere in the early years of the incoming Trump administration. Highly unlikely, most likely not a possibility that this case would be resurrected. Under what circumstances? Impossible to know. And so that is an empty shell. That is an empty argument to maintain that somehow there could be a resurrection of these charges, even during the coming Trump administration. There's a second pushback on this notion that this is not a miscarriage of justice to dismiss these cases, and that is that, yes, indeed, Jack Smith is now working on his final report, and we will see that, and that will be interesting, again, as an historical piece. We know much of what he will say. He's already filed that omnibus briefing statement to Tanya Chutkan. And we know pretty much from the media and also the documents attached to his own document what that trial would have looked like. But that report will be significant. What it is not is a resolution of the judicial decision that Tanya Chutkan had before her until early this past week. That is now gone. And so the case basically is gone. Jack Smith and others plainly finishing up on that report and will be leaving sometime soon after in the wake of this abandoned prosecution under circumstances in which this did not happen. Similarly, the other major constitutional question, procedural question, is whether a president who's suspected of committing crimes, where the Justice Department can avoid conflicts of interest by bringing in an outside prosecutor, these special counsels, to lead a semi-independent investigation into this matter. The judge there, her name is Eileen Cannon, said, no, you can't do that. Only the president can appoint a special counsel. The attorney general cannot do that. She made that decision contrary to Supreme Court decisions, contrary to the precedent that's been in existence for decades. But she made that decision. And that was the decision that was up on appeal to the Court of Appeals for the 11th Circuit. We will now, in the wake of the decision by the attorney general to abandon these cases, never get a 2024 reaffirmation of the capacity of special counsels to do their jobs. Also, a very important thing, not just for us to know academically, but also for the future of the Department of Justice, for the future of future administration of justice principles. If there are circumstances where special counsels need to be appointed by an attorney general, who does that? Well, we think the law still is that an attorney general can do that, but certainly put into some question by virtue of what Eileen Cannon has done. Very good, very right, very decent to know from the 11th Circuit that Eileen Cannon is wrong. Once again, the law remains as it is. Lots of things unresolved, lots of things undefined now that are important to the future of our nation. All of that thrown on the fire pit in the wake of the dismissal by our attorney general, by the Department of Justice, of these two cases that not only apply a principle that doesn't apply right now to a private citizen, but also by virtue of doing this, effectively embracing the very notion that we've railed against so many of us in America, this July 1 decision that there is someone who's above the law. Right now, the Supreme Court, that decision is looming large, not only telling us about a hugely powerful presidency, but also now, based upon the application of this inapplicable policy that a sitting president cannot be prosecuted, extending that to a private citizen. If you are going to be the president of the United States of America, we're going to forego the next almost 2 months when things, good things could have come out of those cases. We're going to forego all that. We're going to apply the principle to protect even you. And we are effectively going to obey in advance. We're going to teach power what it can do, and we're going to offer ourselves without being asked, in the words of Timothy Snyder. An unfortunate and very disappointing development in the rule of law. Of course, we also have those two other cases. One of them is still pending. Actually, two of them still pending. One of them still pending in Manhattan. That's the case in front of Judge Juan Merchan. We talked about this in our previous broadcast. He is now determining what to do also in the wake of the election of Donald Trump. Does he dismiss that hush money case, that state case involving 34 counts of conviction? Donald Trump, a convicted felon coming out of the Manhattan criminal court. Does Juan Merchan dismiss that, knowing that Donald Trump is going to be the president? Or does he, as the deputy, as the district attorney has proposed in that case, does he somehow put all this on the shelf? And does he freeze it for a number of years until after Donald Trump's next term of the presidency? Neither one of those an appropriate and right and rule of law based proposal and approach to this. What plainly the judge, what the court should do in that case is do what we do in all the other criminal cases in America, federal and state. And that is sometime in the next 50 or so days, plenty of time in which to do it, should summon Donald Trump in, issue his decision, issue the judge's decision, that is, on the inapplicability of the immunity decision to this particular case, this state case, again involving a private citizen way back in 2016, and then proceed to sentence him. That should have been done just this past week. According to the judge's own schedule, he suspended that. No new date for sentencing. He is wrestling now with what he describes as one of two alternatives: dismissal outright, which once again would be an affirmation of what the Supreme Court said, that indeed a president is above the law, not even subject to sentencing for a criminal conviction entered by a jury of peers unanimously beyond a reasonable doubt over a 7-week trial period. Finding in the end that that's meaningless and that, in fact, the case now should be dismissed, basically absolving Donald Trump of that responsibility determined by a trier of fact. again, standing the rule of law on its head. We don't know exactly what Juan Merchan will do, but the other alternative on his docket proposed by the district attorney is, again, once again to suspend all this for years. Equally inappropriate, equally unjust, if you will, in terms of bringing this to resolution, especially when you can do it promptly. You can do this in a day, anytime between now and January 20th. All of that could be done. And yet we'll take a look down the road what happens in the weeks ahead in that case, and also the Georgia case, which is also pending still before the Court of Appeals. All of that a matter of discussion here on Amicus, a law review.
A new choice. Madison's Real News and Great Conversation, 92.7 WMDX.
It's the sound of a soda, considered one of the coolest things made in Wisconsin. Jolly Good has been around since the 1960s. Cryer Foods makes it in Random Lake, which is in Sheboygan County. But Cryer started as a canning company in 1913. What was being canned there? Sauerkraut? Peas? Beets? The answer coming up.
At Jolly Good, we believe in quality.
Soda turned into an important revenue stream when production at the canning company slowed in the colder months. So what was being canned there? Sauerkraut, peas, beets? All three, plus juice, soups, and more. By the 1960s, Cryer quit canning and went all in on Jolly Good soda.
For flavor and value, Jolly Good's got it.
The latest resurgence of Jolly Good makes it a slice of Wisconsin for yesterday and today. I'm Terry Barr for the Civic Media Radio Network.
Welcome to Madison's Real News and Great Conversation, 92.7 WMDX.
This is Amicus, a law review. My name is Jim Santel. Thank you for joining me and Max for this, our weekend broadcast about all things justice related. Turning now in this, our final segment of our first hour and continuing into the second hour of Amicus, a law review, a return to one of our common subjects, and that is the United States Supreme Court. Yes, that's right. It continues to do things there in Washington, D.C., right across the parking lot from the United States Capitol building, right down the street from the White House, and yes, just within walking distance of the Federal District Court, where until this past week, Donald Trump was a defendant in that insurrection case. All of that within walking distance, as you all well know, in Washington, D.C. The Supreme Court right there on Capitol Hill, active in this, its 2024-2025 term. We have talked a lot about some of the statistics here. It's important to update where they are, because to this point in their term, they have granted certiorari. That, once again, is that legal term, that Latin term that says we're going to review what a lower court, typically a lower appeals court, has done. Sometimes a Supreme Court coming out of a particular state, we've seen that too, we're going to review what the lower court has done, determine whether or not they've applied the law properly to the facts, whether there's some error that's been made, or they've gotten it all right. They have done that now in this term, granted certiorari in 47 different cases. They come from all different circuits. Significantly, where do they come from? Well, yes, indeed, the Fifth Circuit, which produces last term and this term, apparently once again on track to produce the greatest number of cases from any of the circuits nationwide, whopping 10 different cases from the Fifth Circuit alone, the Supreme Court taking a lot of those cases. The track record on that, plainly, has been to reverse a lot of what the Fifth Circuit does at the Supreme Court level. Five of them from the Ninth Circuit, which is that huge district out there in the West, including California, that circuit that usually has the highest number of cases coming from its court to the United States Supreme Court. There are two from our circuit, the Seventh Circuit here, Wisconsin, Illinois, and Indiana. And there are somewhere between one and four other matters being heard from each of the other circuits in the nation. Up to this point, there have been 16 oral arguments, which, yes, again, you can hear. You can hear them live when they're conducted. You can hear them on tape by going on to the Supreme Court docket, going on to the Supreme Court website, and listening to the Supreme Court justices, all of them, all of them sparring with, arguing with each other sometimes, but often, most often, with counsel appearing in front of them. Eight more arguments are scheduled for the month of December, coming up fairly soon. Nine in January, four in February, and two way out in March. And again, more to be argued, more to be decided in the coming months, plainly until May or June, July of next year. They've only issued one formal opinion up to this point, and that had to do with a procedural issue in a death penalty case. And that case going back down to the lower court for some few additional fact finding. Let's talk about what's going on in the near future here just this past week and coming up in the coming week itself. Well, among those 47 cases, it's very clear that the Supreme Court is going to take another look at, another attempt to address this thing called agency discretion, agency expertise. You recall well that in the past term, the previous 2023-2024 term, right before it issued that major terrible decision on presidential immunities, the Friday before it issued this decision in Loper Bright Enterprises versus Raimondo. That was the case in which the Supreme Court overturned 40 years, four decades of tradition and history. They rejected the notion definitively of what's called Chevron deference, that is relying upon people who know what they're talking about, relying upon the experts in agencies to give the courts a sense of what is right and what is good and what is decent. They said no more. We don't need to defer anymore. And so in Loper Bright Enterprises, the Supreme Court took this major wrecking ball to the independence, if you will, the discretion, the judgment, the expertise of our agencies in saying that judges no longer have to comply with that doctrine. They went on in a case called Jarchese, you may recall, versus the Security and Exchange Commission, prohibiting the use of some administrative mechanisms to combat securities fraud. In that case, another attack upon agencies. Well, you might have thought that the Supreme Court is now done with that issue, but no, indeed it is not. It has a number of cases, as you know well, in this term alone, involving the ATF and other matters out there. The Environmental Protection Agency is also in its eyeshot here and its focus as well, including the Federal Communications Commission. In a case in which they're reviewing, at least the predicate for this is they're reviewing a program of the Federal Communications Commission to bring telephone and broadband services to some impoverished communities and rural areas throughout our nation. This is an administration proposal of the FCC to encourage communication, telephonic broadband services to places where up to now, believe it or not, they still have not had those kinds of access to good communication across our nation and locally as well. So an attempt, again, to bring those mechanisms, that technology, to communities that have been underserved up to this point. And, of course, that is challenged. That is challenged in a case called Consumers Research. That's the party that's challenging this program of the FCC. And it's opposed by a group, not surprisingly, called the Schools, Health, and Libraries Broadband Coalition. They're in favor of communication. They're in favor of education. Imagine that in all of our areas, including those that have not been sufficiently wealthy and sufficiently affluent up to this point to have those kinds of communication accesses. And so this goes up to the Fifth Circuit once again. The Fifth Circuit says, nope, FCC, you can't do this. The Universal Service Contribution Mechanisms, that's the mechanism by which this is being done and financed. It is incompatible with our constitutional structure. That's the way that the appeals court says this is unconstitutional rules, that it cannot be done. And the petitioners, again, take this up to the Supreme Court. And just this past week, the Supreme Court has indicated that it will review that case. And along the way, it reviewed something called the non-delegation doctrine. The non-delegation doctrine, in particular, in support of the review of this case, Supreme Court Justice Sam Alito wrote this. He said, since 1935, this court has uniformly rejected non-delegation arguments and upheld provisions that authorized agencies to adopt important rules pursuant to extraordinarily capacious standards. Capacious, a word that at least I don't use routinely, but capacious meaning broad and expansive and all kinds of things underneath the umbrella. He says, I support the effort to reconsider that approach. As Amicus Law Review continues, we'll talk about what the non-delegation doctrine is all about, why this case is so important, a continuation, once again, of the attack of the Supreme Court upon our agencies in America. Stay with us for that discussion of the Supreme Court and much more here on the broadcast stations of Civic Media.
This is Madison's Real News and Great Conversation, 92.7 WMDX.
Todd Albaugh.
Hey, everybody, join us next time, an all-new live show back in the studio. Join us for a look back at the holiday weekend and prepare you for the week ahead.
The Todd Albaugh Show, weekdays noon till 2.
Happy holidays, happy holidays, happy holidays.
Oh, hello, everyone. Judy Summers from Summers Tree Farm, located on Rocky Dell Road, 3 miles west of Middleton, exit 250 Airport Road. The farm opens the day after Thanksgiving, 8 to 5 daily. We close at noon Christmas Eve. Visit our website at summerschristmastreefarm.com. We look forward to seeing you. Happy holidays from the Summers family.
This is your local Civic Media radio station. Want to hear even more? Anytime? Find all of it at civicmedia.us.
This is 92.7 WMDX Columbus, Madison's home for real news and great conversation. A Civic Media station.